Hi, my name is Mandy Giles and I'm talking today, Thursday the 26th of February 2015 with Wendy Sacklier. We're meeting at the Curtin premises of the Curtin and District Historical Society as part of the Curtin Living Memories Project. Wendy and her family moved to their home in Nelson Place, Curtin in 1972 and are still living there today. Wendy's someone who's contributed a lot to the Curtin and the broader Canberra community. She worked as a speech pathologist for 40 years, but it's her community work that I thought we'd highlight today. Now, Wendy, let's go back to when you first came to Curtin. Why did you arrive in Curtin in 1972?
We had been living in Hobart, where Mike was the state archivist. But we were both from the mainland, as one always said, if you lived in Tasmania. And I was from Queensland, so my family was still there, and Michael's family was still in New South Wales. And we'd always hoped that we could come back to the mainland with his work, and a position became available at the ANU in the Noel Butlin Archives. So that brought us to Canberra.
And what was Curtin like when you arrived here?
When we were looking at houses, we'd drive through Curtin and it seemed to have more trees than anywhere else on the south side. And somehow we were drawn to the south side of the lake. Seems silly, I know, but we were living in a university house in Deakin when we first came, and it was very wooded and very pleasant, and we used to come across to the Curtin shops. And then when we decided we would buy a house, we came here first and looked at our house in Nelson Place. And we would always have a coffee at the milk bar, and Vince Kalakarinos was the person who welcomed us to Curtin. It was always had the feeling of a village community, the setting at the shops. And it really isn't all that different, I suppose, in the way it feels. The shops were a little bit different because we had a department store here, we had a shoe shop, we had two chemists, we had a fruiterer, a butcher, two pharmacies. It was very different in that sense, but it was an important way to bring a community together with that variety of services available, with the doctor and the dentist as well.
So in terms of the Kalakarinkoses, I mean, there you are today greeting John and Viola, and you've obviously become firm friends over the years.
Yes.
Since that meeting of Vince.
Yes.
All those years ago.
Yes, indeed, very much so.
So we'll touch on being a speech pathologist. We should cover that briefly. I mean, where did you work for all that time as a speech pathologist?
I should go back to why I chose that as a profession, I suppose. As a small child living in far west Queensland, we didn't see many people. And we had a carpenter who came to work on the property, and he was profoundly deaf. And he, in fact, was mute, so he communicated through signing. I was seven, and I was fascinated by this man who couldn't speak. And he taught me to fingerspell, and I just was engrossed. And I said to my dad, when I grow up, I think I'd like to be somebody who helps people who can't speak. And he said, I think you'll be very good at that because you talk a lot. But he got it wrong, because you have to be a good listener. So I've worked in Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Hobart, and in Toronto in Canada, and, of course, in Canberra since 1973.
Who did you work for in Canberra?
Always with the government. It's had various names, as organisations tend to have. When I first started working here, it was under the mental health branch, it was under the education branch, it was under health. For the last 20 years that I worked there, it was called CHADS, Child Health and Development Service, And we worked as a team with OTs, physios, social worker and medical officers. And that was with babies, children under three, that last 20 years. The earlier work had been in deaf classes around Canberra. There was a high incidence of deafness in children until the rubella program came in. So after 1969, there were very few children born deaf because of rubella.
Well, that's good news.
So that was a big plus. And the incidence is much lower now than it used to be.
In fact, as a speech pathologist, you invented a cup for young children to drink with. Just tell us a bit about that.
I developed that in response to a need because there was nothing in the marketplace suitable for assisting babies and young children to learn to drink from an open cup. So the cup was designed to assist babies to get in the position of a chin tuck, which is important for swallowing once you begin to drink from a cup. It's different for babies sucking prior to learning to drink from a cup. So that I think helped a number of children with issues with their development, physical particularly. And that was very gratifying to see, you know, the support it gave to parents and young children.
Now, obviously, while you were still working, you noticed an ad for a gathering of people wanting to get involved in quilting.
Yes. Well, in fact, I knew about the ad going in because the ad was put in by Judy Thompson, who still lives in Colbatch Place. And she and her husband had been overseas in Washington, I think. And Margaret Rolfe, who lived in Curtin, had been overseas in America, and they had both been aware of the resurgence in patchwork and quilting in America. And we all did sewing and we were friends, and they suggested putting an ad in the paper. And I think five people turned up that evening, and that was the very beginning. We called ourselves the Patchwork Group, and then we became incorporated as the Canberra Quilters. And it's a very strong organisation. We've had over 500 members some years. We hold an annual exhibition, and I'm still quite involved with it. So I enjoy that enormously.
So when it first started, how did it go? Did you meet every month or a couple of weeks?
We met every month, and we'd meet in our own homes. But when we got up to 30 people, we found it a bit hard to have the meetings in someone's home. I think the last time we met in someone's home, it was two-storey, fortunately, and people were sitting all the way up the steps. And then we started meeting in various church halls. And we now have our own premises in the Cook Primary School, which is now a hub of art, I suppose. There's various organisations who reside in that facility, and that's worked very well.
And teaching patchwork has been important for you too.
It has, yes. I've always taught either at home or been invited to teach somewhere, which I've enjoyed. But the day after I retired from work as a speech pathologist, I walked into Addicted to Fabric, as one would, and Kerry Gavin, who works there, said to me, "Ah, we need someone to teach beginners." And I said, "Oh, I haven't taught patchwork for 15 years on a regular basis." So I started teaching patchwork there, and did so for 11 years, two classes every week. And that worked out at 32 or 64 classes a year I did there.
That's a lot.
And some classes had up to 15 in the class. But it was wonderful. And my background was perfect, because once I had a profoundly deaf person doing patchwork, somebody who had cerebral palsy doing patchwork, people who'd had strokes. So my background with about perception and visual perception and auditory perception was really very useful.
Fantastic. And in fact, as a quilter yourself, you are renowned as, and I believe you've got one of your quilts in the Powerhouse Museum and in America some as well.
Yes, I participated in an Australian exhibition in America in 2006, I think it was. So there were 8 quilters who were selected, and our quilts went over for a period of several months at the American Quilt Museum in Paducah, which is a custom-built, beautiful building to house quilts and conserve them.
Now, that's not the only community organisation you've been involved with. Another one is the QE2 Family Centre, or the Mothercraft Society,
yes,
which are both involved. Just tell us a little bit about those organisations and your involvement.
Yes, the Canberra Mothercraft Society is one of the oldest societies in the ACT. I think the older one, the one that is older, is the Cycle Club, which is interesting. So 1926, the Canberra Mothercraft Society started, and it proved to be a most valuable society supporting families in Canberra, coming to Canberra in their droves, as they did, with no supports. So with the Mothercraft nurses and the occasional care centres, that was a huge assistance to women and families. And I became involved with QE2 in 1983 when I first started to work with children and with babies. And I used to consult at the old QE2, which was in Civic then. So when I retired, I thought, I admired the organisation so much and what they were doing to assist young families, that I went on the board and have stayed on the board since 2001.
Well, QE2 is actually located in Curtin now.
Yes.
So what services do they provide?
Well, they supply the residential service for mothers and babies, which also includes fathers as well. They have 10 suites there. There are 13 altogether, and 3 more are to be opened now. Of course, that will require more resource and more funding to do that. They also have other programs, again, in response to need. So one of the issues that became evident was grandparents supporting grandchildren because of drug and alcohol abuse with the parents. And a program was set up in conjunction with Mary Mead and Relationships Australia. And that's proved to be extremely valuable service. Part of that program is the Grand Jugglers, and that's a program designed for the children to learn circus skills. And in so doing, bringing these children together, it brings the grandparents together in a very informal way, so that's a support network as well. So that's proved to be very useful. They have other programs, including Relaxing into Parenting, which is for new parents prior to the birth of their baby, so that not only do they learn about the birth of the baby, which most of the focus used to always be on, but about attachment and caring for your baby and sharing with your partner and a whole range of issues. There is a counsellor at QE2 employed who runs those programs and trains others in the community to do the programs as well. So I think one of the philosophies of CMS is identifying an issue, getting it started, training others, stepping back so that the shared knowledge, you know, is in the community and not restricted to the experts, which can happen sometimes.
What's your role on the board, and what kind of input do you provide?
The committee that I'm presently on is the scholarship committee, and we have raised a lot of money, $250,000, I think, And from that investment, the investment from that money, we can provide scholarships for members of staff to upgrade their skills or do a special course or something pertaining to their work. And my role is a part of the scholarship committee to receive the applications, consider their worth and the outcomes, and approve that funding. I have been on other committees as well, but that's one I'm on at the moment.
So raising $250,000 is no mean feat. How did you do that?
No, we did all sorts of things. We did get some very fine donations from people who supported the idea in the medical field, and we have had all sorts of theatre parties, stalls. We have a group called the Knitters, the Wednesday Knitters. It's a group of women who meet at QE2 every Wednesday afternoon, and they knit for every organisation in the world, I think, you know, for orphanages in Romania and all sorts of things. But they knit for the stall that we have twice a year up here at the shops, and various other dinners and outings and things. So the money has come in.
And that's not the only thing you've been raising money for. I read recently that you were instrumental in raising about $9,000 for diabetes.
Yes, we've been having what we call the fundraising bazaar at our home. My granddaughter Neve was diagnosed when she was 11. She's now 17. So for the last 6 years, in November, we've held a fundraiser at our home. And it's amazing the support that we've received from all sorts of people who've donated items that come along. And Michael and I, we provide the refreshments along with our friends, including Viola, as you can imagine. So we provide drinks and afternoon tea. And that sets up a feeling of, you know, we're here, it's part of the fun, spend my money on one of the rooms in the house we designate to a shop. My friends in the Dot to Dot group, which is our sewing crafty group in the street, we make jewellery and cook and make jam. And so last year was our best year. We raised $9,580, but we also raised money for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation with a stall up here at the shops. So our total fundraising for last year was over $12,000.
Where does this motivation come from?
I think it's in my genes. My parents living in a very isolated part of Australia. My mother was very involved in the CWA. My father was a life member of the Royal Flying Doctor Service because we received those services. The little town that I lived outside as a small child was McKinley, which you'd be familiar with because that's where Crocodile Dundee was filmed, the pub. That was our local pub. And, you know, people supported each other. That was part of living in that kind of environment, I suppose. So my first memories are going, you know, into town with my mother laden with cakes and things, and going to the CWA hall, and it's continued from there, I suppose, because with the quilting brings people together. It's a shared exercise. I don't know how many quilts I've made with others that we've donated to Malkara. I can think of when we gave them a quilt when they built their first swimming pool for the children, and various other organisations. It's just being part of the community. And that's what I think the bazaar did. It brought the community together. And everyone had a good time, but we're able to support organisations that, you know, are looking for a cure for diabetes type 1 and for other organisations. One in particular is called Insulin for Life. I'm most impressed with this organisation. They have very plain black and white paper I think all of the money goes overseas to support children. I mean, ours is a drop in the ocean, I know, but if it's helping someone to survive, because insulin is not as easily accessible as it is in our society.
Definitely. Yeah. In fact, getting back to your upbringing, and you said your father supported the Flying Doctor Service all his life, but in fact he was the recipient at one stage.
Yes, he was. When he was 50, he, as a very young man, he'd had his appendix out, I think, in about 1932 in Cloncurry. Well, I can't imagine that that would have been a very successful operation at the time, because anaesthetic then, you know, is a cloth on your face. And anyway, he, because of the surgery, he had strangulation of his bowel, and he was a very ill man. And the flying doctor was called in. Our flying doctor was a man called Tim O'Leary from Ireland, wonderful man. And to land the plane, they couldn't land on the strip, which was claypan, because it had rained. So they bulldozed part of a sandhill for the plane to land on. And they got down. When they were flying off, my dad, who was delirious apparently, said, "The door's open." And it was. They managed to shut the door. My mother was also on board, so I guess that was a bit more weight to carry, plus baggage, of course. So they just got off, apparently.
Oh, wow. Now, even today you've been telling me about the National Council of Women, because that's another organisation you're involved
in. I began to be interested in National Council of Women through the Canberra Mothercraft Society, because I'd go to the board meetings and there was always information, was always on the agenda, report from the National Council of Women. I thought, this is very interesting. And it was always interesting information, and I could tell that there had been a cohesion with these two organisations, and they didn't have a delegate to represent Canberra Mothercraft. So I thought, you know, I could find out a bit more about that. So I've been involved there probably since about 2002, I think. And I've really enjoyed it. It's very progressive organisation, supporting families, quite highly organised. We have conferences, and it's been a great pleasure to be part of it. So I report back each month to Canberra Mothercraft about whatever's been happening.
So do you get together involved in national conferences?
Yes, yes. And when I was president of National Council ACT, which was only for 18 months because I then had to pull back because of Michael being unwell, we had a conference which we ran at the Southern Cross Club about older women and homelessness, which is a big issue. And that was very successful. We've had some good outcomes as a result of the paper that we presented after that. So that was a good thing to have done that year.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you and hear about the myriad of things you're involved with. It's really impressive. And I guess we should come back to Curtin at the end of our interview and just ask you what, you know, what it's meant to you being involved in this community and been living in Curtin for 44 years.
Curtin, we're just so grateful. The best decision we ever made in our lives for Michael and I and our family to move into the Radburn. It's just got a beautiful feel about it. We love the bird life. It's safe for animals, for our own domestic animals. And I guess when we saw it first, it was a dust bowl. It had been a very dry winter. The trees were quite small, and but you could tell that it was the park that we bought, not the home. It was the park. And we could see that by where our house is, accessibility to the shops, we had one car then, of course, as most families did, for me, with a young family, I could walk to the shops to do the shopping with the pram. I could walk Rod to preschool when he was four. And, you know, having a bike, you mixed with the local people who are all wonderful. You've made some marvellous friends in the area. And we don't want to move, of course. We want to stay there as long as we can.
Well, you should. And, you know, even though I wanted to finish, I just think I should ask you to explain what the Radburn development is in case someone was listening and they didn't
know. Yes, I gather, I'm not absolutely sure where it is in America, but it's a development of housing where the front of the houses look onto parkland. So the access by car is at the rear. And I know a friend of mine, when she was coming to see us many years ago when her children were little, one of her daughters said, "I don't know why Mrs. Sacklea lives here. She mustn't have any friends because it's all there are all these fences at the back you can't see over." And it does look a bit like that, but it's the accessibility to houses in the front, in the park, which is so safe, that it's just wonderful seeing children playing outside in the trees and the with their football or their soccer ball or whatever.
Well, I can concur with that because, in fact, we used to live over the other side of the park to you, and having three young boys living in that location for 12 years was just perfect.
Yes. I do have some literature somewhere on where the program was based. Apparently there's one in Fisher, but not quite as extensive, and there's certainly one at Charnwood. But its layout has proved not as successful as the Curtin one.
And I guess the nice thing is that we've both experienced, and you were yet again one of the community facilitators, was the gatherings, or it seems to facilitate people getting together for, say, Christmas drinks in the park.
Yes, yes, we should, I think we've still got a little bit of daylight saving. We should do it before it stops. But that they were enjoyable, weren't they, those gatherings we had, getting all the families together and saying, I'm from number 27 or I'm from number 6. Yes, wonderful.
Okay, well, thanks very much. It's
Thank
been fantastic
you. Thanks, Mandy.
Hearing from you today, Wendy.
Thank you.